And welcome everyone to a very special episode of Podcasting Them Softly. This is Nick, and of course I'm joined by Frank. What's going on, buddy?
Not much, man. I'm very excited for this chat.
Yes, tonight is very special. Frank and I are extremely excited to be joined by a film critic, historian, screenwriter, and author, F.X. Feeney. His latest book, Orson Welles, Power, Heart, and Soul, is available from the Critical Press and through Amazon. Prior to dealing with Welles, F.X. contributed to the great filmmaker book series from Taschen with the definitive exploration of Michael Mann and his works. And tonight, F.X. is here to discuss the 20th anniversary of Michael Mann's iconic crime drama Heat, which is one of our favorite movies, and it's a film that continually stands as a landmark in American cinema. FX has written two screenplays, The Big Brass Ring, which was directed by George Hickenlooper and was based on an unproduced script by Orson Welles, and the Roger Corman classic Frankenstein Unbound. He served as film critic and creative consultant for the now-famous Z Channel back in the mid-'80s, and his articles have appeared in L.A. Weekly, Movie Line, People Magazine, Variety, Vanity Fair, and the magazine for the Writers Guild of America West. He also wrote the Roman Polanski filmmaker book for Taschen, which is an extraordinary resource on that filmmaker. And he served as co-producer on the fantastic documentary Z Channel, A Magnificent Obsession. Welcome to the show, FX. This is a true honor to get a chance to chat with you. We're both very excited.
The honor's all mine, Nick and Frank. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, this is great. We already did one of our weekly podcasts on Heat a long time ago when we first started, so it's great to come back to this film because, like Nick said, this is one of our all-time favorite films. I'm curious as to the first time you saw this film.
You know, the first time I saw it was a couple of weeks before it opened, and that was now 20 years ago. Amazing to think. It was, December of 1995, and it was a cold, rainy day, and we all went, to the Warner Brothers lot. It was at their big studio, their big theater on that lot, and it was a perfect circumstance under which to see that film. And, we went in, all the critics, we'd received no advance notice. It was only, it was Michael Mann's new film, the first one since Last of the Mohicans, so... And, De Niro and Pacino were in it. I figure, okay, that sets you anticipating. But otherwise, I knew nothing. And so saw it with, virginal. Now, at that point, I'd never even seen L.A. Takedown. One of my that was an early version of the story that was done, as a pilot. It was intended as a pilot. It wasn't meant to get out there. But it aired at some point. So a couple of critics were up on it. But I was seeing Heat just for the first time, and I was completely taken with it. I was moved on several levels. One is, of course, just because you start that movie innocently with De Niro sort of stealing that ambulance, and you're just getting involved with him, and then you get involved with the cop, it's Hannah, played by Al Pacino, and you watch these men in their elaborate dance across Los Angeles through the course of that film, and I felt I was in the presence of a movie akin to Lawrence of Arabia, because it had an epic length. That surprised me. I didn't know how long it was going to be, and I didn't care. I didn't resist it at all. It actually used every ounce of my brain for the long duration that it was on screen, and I was quite taken with it and shaken. I remember I was walking on shaky legs when I emerged from it, and I wondered, how is this going to do? Because it's a very mysterious movie. For all that you can understand the plot every which way, from 1 minute to the next, everything's clear. You know what people are thinking without them having to say a word. So it's incredibly lucid filmmaking, but I wondered how the public would react, And it was very interesting to me that it got very little attention, really, during the season of its first release. I don't know that it performed very well at the box office. I could stand corrected on that, but my understanding, as I began to write about it years later, was that it did not begin to do well until
DVD. It did like $67 million domestic or something like that.
And that seems, funnily enough, you think of that as kind of a lowball figure, especially in the mid-90s, when you know, when say Pulp Fiction, that, you know, only months before had been doing, you know, close to $200 million at the box office. So you go, wow, how is this movie not scoring, you know? But I think people, you know, it's a movie that is made for what is now called the long tail, the afterlife of a movie, which is now really the main life of a movie when you start to see it in repeated forms, either on pay television or on DVD. And there, I think it became, you know, like a symphonic piece of music that people that people really gravitated towards and would see again and again, because it does support repeated viewing.
So what was it like? Because obviously we'll all get a chance to share our first experiences with the film, because it is important to all of us. But just to ask you a little bit more about your first viewing. So you saw it on the lot. So was that a screening with other industry, you know, collaborators, or was it a screening for critics and you know, people like that of that nature? What was the mood like? And if you can tell us who was there?
Well, it was primarily journalists. I remember speaking to my friend Virginia Campbell, who was the editor in chief at Movie Line at that time, and to Mike Wilmington, who was, you know, a major critic for the Chicago papers, though based here in L.A. And you know, it was, and we were all as silent as if we were coming out of a church after seeing it. That's what I remember. It was not a movie that we were raving about, but that, you know, if you've seen enough movies and be it, if you're enough of a student of your own reaction, especially as a professional journalist, you know, I was conscious that, boy, this movie's going in deep. This is like, you know, it's a feeling I had when I first saw Taxi Driver. You know, there are movies that you experience rather than see, and nothing shuts you up like experience, as Flannery O'Connor once put it. And, you know, we were all kind of bumping into each other in kind of an interesting and interested silence as we were walking out. We didn't discuss it much in detail, but we all knew we'd seen something unique and special. That was emerging for, you know, that I could tell, especially from talking to Virginia. We were all, you know, we knew we'd been somewhere.
Yeah, it really is one of those. It really is one of those transporting movies that I think really for anybody when they get a chance to see it for the first time. I think that, as you said, there's an epic sweep to it, and while also being epic, the screenplay very wisely gets intimate with the characters, and you really get a chance to know them. And I think that the length that you described, you know, the basically the 3 hours of, you know, runtime, it's really just beautifully used in all respects. There doesn't feel to be a moment that is dragging or repetitive or anything like that. I've always felt that it's a film where the length has been very well served, and it's always felt to me like a movie where Michael Mann basically got a chance to tell exactly the story, at least I've always felt, exactly the story that he was trying to get across. And I, you know, you hear all the time about filmmakers, you know, their visions are compromised, they've got to take this out, they've got to take that out.
Right.
And the movie's always felt to me like something that just felt like a complete vision. And it's been interesting because, you know, you watch the stuff, you know, you watch the deleted scenes on the DVD and you hear about, you know, certain aspects that could have been or might have been, but really it really is one of those movies that feels complete. And I can remember when I saw it for the first time, I was 15 years old. My father had really just started to open up the floodgates of cinema on me. The year before, I had seen Pulp Fiction and Natural Born Killers in the theater, and those two movies really just blew me away and made me aware of cinema as an art form. And 95 came along, and I had like Leaving Las Vegas and Heat and Dead Man Walking and Casino, and the 1-2 punch of Casino and Heat were just extraordinary. And seeing Heat, I can remember just being utterly blown away by the scope of it, the largeness. I don't think I'd ever seen a movie evoke Los Angeles in that way on the big screen at 15 years of age. Certainly when I saw T2, there was an element of that, but there's something so unique about Heat and the locations used and the way that the film has this sprawling sense of place. Yeah. And I can remember seeing it as a high school student and never been to Los Angeles. I grew up in Connecticut. And I can remember saying, wow, this movie, it feels exotic. It feels, feels ahead of its, you know, in retrospect, it felt ahead of its time. Frank, what are some of your earliest recollections of seeing the film?
I was 10 when the film came out in theaters. So I didn't see it in theaters, but my dad, I would watch almost every Robert De Niro or Al Pacino film with my dad growing up. I mean, I saw Goodfellas and a lot of stuff when I was way too young to be watching a lot of that stuff, but I had to have seen it. I know I saw it on VHS, so it had to be like around 1996, so I was 11 or so. Ooh. And I don't remember a lot of my first viewing, but what I do remember of it was at the end of the film during the it's not a shootout, but like the epic climax of the two of them coming together and one's going to die and one's going to live at the airport. I remember being terrified. And that film freaked me out for a very long time until I got older and I started watching it. And I mean, now I've probably seen the film over 30 times,
wow.
But I think, you know, I was just, I don't want to say I was traumatized. That's too strong of a word, but it was definitely the intensity of that end really shook me when I was young, and I don't think I saw that film for quite a while after that because I was freaked out by it.
That makes perfect sense, though. I mean, when you're 10 years old, I had that experience with a movie I saw for the first time on TV when I was 10 called From Here to Eternity with Montgomery Clift and Burt Lancaster and, you know, and Frank Sinatra. Now, there are several wonderful actors in there, all sympathetic characters, and a couple of them are going to die. You know, and you can actually feel that even as a kid, you knew, oh boy, you know, because Pearl Harbor's coming, you know, something's going to happen here. And, you know, as William Styron, who wrote Sophie's Choice, once said very well that you, after you read a novel, you want to feel that you've lived several lives in the course of reading it. And I think Michael Mann and Heat gives you that experience of living several lives. You get completely involved in both the lives of the cop and the criminals, you know, particularly the two leads, but everybody around them, you know, the character called Chris, you know, played by Val Kilmer, or Charlene, his wife, played by Ashley Judd, you know, you get their lives very deeply. And, you know, when I was watching as a kid, From Here to Eternity, I mean, it's like, even after I'd seen it a couple times, I knew who was going to die. I would suffer their death in a very deep way, I think, as you only can when you're a kid, because, you know, you haven't really dealt with your own mortality yet, and the way through is to, you know, sometimes with a sympathetic character in a story.
Yeah, and Frank, your comment about, you know, at 11, you know, being scared by it, I totally can understand and in a way relate. I mean, when I was seeing it in the theater at 15, you know, I knew in my head that one of these guys is going to have to die, or someone's going to have to go to jail, or someone's got to win. And what I think, just, you know, one of the many brilliant things that Mann did in the film is that, you know, as bad as Robert De Niro is, I don't, you know, you know, I think that most people would be lying if they said that you don't root for him at some point during the narrative of the film. I mean, you know, Mann was able to create a villain that was multi-layered and had a real humanity to him at times, despite his violent code and his distinct set of principles, you know, the icy principles. And yep. I think that the anxiety, I remember feeling anxious during that last sequence at LAX, you know, the first time seeing it, because I didn't know who I wanted to win or die. You know, who's the good guy here? Who's the bad guy? Who are you rooting for, De Niro or Pacino? I mean, and when you haven't seen a ton of movies yet and you're not quite as experienced with cinema, I think that it can be viewed in a very different way. Now, just like you, Frank, having seen it 20 or 30 times over 20 years, and that's just being probably conservative with that number. I mean, it's insane.
Yeah.
You know, I, every time I watch the film, it's almost like having a new experience, a new response to the material.
Yeah, it's interesting you brought up like De Niro being the villain, and what made me, you know, it makes me think, it's like, you know, is De Niro the villain? Is he an anti-hero? It's like, he's the parallel life to Pacino. They just each made a important decision a long time ago, but they're a mirror of each other. And, you know, how sympathetic is Neil McCauley in that film compared to, I mean, what, you have Kevin Gage playing Wayne Grow, mm-hmm. you have Hank Azaria, you know, as the shitty philanderer that's ruining Val Kilmer's life, kind of, even though Val Kilmer's self-destructive-ish. And then William Fichtner is Roger Van Zandt.
Yeah.
All three of those guys are brilliant in the film, and they each like escalate the film with their own sleaziness. Probably not nearly as much as Kevin Gage is as Wayne Grow. I mean, that character, oh my God. But you know,
well,
here's what I think.
If I may weigh in on this, I think these guys, you know, what Michael Mann does so well in every movie he makes is he will find the wound inside a character, right? And so, you know, the wound for Neil McCauley is that he's basically state raised. He's a guy much like the protagonist, James Caan's protagonist in Thief, a guy who is state raised. He's, you know, I mean, Michael Mann's view of the world, I think, is that we're all sort of, so to speak, born in solitary, and some of us are unlucky enough to actually spend our lives in prisons, you know, and you know, you're born on the wrong side of the tracks, and it's how do you survive, you know? And so I think as we take on De Niro in the movie, you know, remember there's the character, you know, played by Amy Brenneman, who he meets at the lunch counter, and they begin their affair, and that's, you know, her love for him, her angle on him makes him sympathetic because we see him as she sees him, which is somebody who is, you know, I mean, she's terrified when she realizes what a major criminal he is, but at the same time, she understands and that he is a survivor. He's in effect a frontiersman surviving in a jungle, you know, and her love for him is very akin to the love that Madeline Stowe feels for Hawkeye, you know, in Last of the Mohicans. I mean, there's a, you know, there are layers of the jungle that we're all born into, and Neil McCauley's code is one of the few things about him that is, that hints at a possible redemption, because he is somebody who is really simply is surviving, and he doesn't deliberately set out to kill anybody, but you know, when he realizes, okay, it's this or prison, boom, he does so without remorse. And so that's another side of his wound. You know, it becomes the negative force that he brings into the world that he has to pay for on his way out, so to speak. You know, but
definitely. Yeah. And I think that just like to tie into the idea of every character having a wound, I think, which is so true. And I'm just like flashing through the movies as you brought that up and thinking about each one. And you're so right. I also think that one of the things that is so interesting about what Mann does with his characters is that they are, you know, he presents in Heat two people who are, as Frank said, they're the opposite side of a coin, but they are also the same. And I think that the notion of duality is something that has just been so prevalent in his work, and it's explored in such a way, such an introspective way at times, especially in Heat, and you know, in The Insider as well, and the theme of loneliness. I mean, I think that great line of dialogue, I'm alone but not lonely.
That like goes through my head almost every day.
Yeah, and that
I think that's the best line of dialogue in the film. But sorry, go ahead.
No, and it applies to so many of Michael Mann's films and so many of his characters. I mean, think about the aloneness that, you know, Jeffrey Wigand, Russell Crowe would feel in The Insider, or you know, at certain points, like Jamie Foxx driving the cab, where he's probably feeling like, oh my God, like I'm stuck with this killer. And you know, I think that the notion of loneliness is something that's permeated his work, you know, in all respects. And it's taken to like just an extreme degree in Heat, because the Pacino character and the De Niro character, they are men driven by their work and everything else comes second. And they are, you know, they're vessels. They're empty vessels by the time that, you know, the day is over and they've come home and they've done their thing and they have nothing left to give. And, you know, De Niro, like you said, FX, the relationship that you see form between Amy Brenneman and De Niro is that much more affecting, because you can see the cracks in De Niro's facade and that he probably would have a heart for somebody if the situations were different.
Yes. And, you know, Michael's own interpretation of the film, which is very palpably there. You know, I understood exactly what he meant when he said this, is that, you know, it's because McCauley has opened himself up woman's love, that, you know, as he's headed for the airport and he's headed for escape, that he makes essentially the bad judgment call when the John Voight character calls him, the Nate type of John Voight calls him and says where Wangro is, and you have that moment in the tunnel where I think the music and the sound are beautifully dislocated from the image, so that we're really inside the tunnel that he's in that moment, and he makes the decision to go after Wangro, which defeats everything. I mean, it absolutely blows up his world. It's the one moment when he does something spontaneous. And Michael Mann's point to me was, that he's found in love. There's been this element of chaos that's been introduced into his sort of heart and in his system. So he can't, make the usual cold judgment calls that he makes, that he's grown conditioned to. It's just an interesting, fantastic, meaningful paradox, And it's interesting too. I mean, something that should not be lost about this movie, because, a lot of critics will say, he's, subverting genre. He's doing all kinds of interesting things with the crime film. And really, it's important to bear in mind that, Michael Mann does not think in terms of style or genre. I think he's interested in what makes the world work. And to understand the way the world works, he understands professionals, but he also understands criminals. He'll study criminal behavior, especially at the level of professional crime. It's worth noting that in the late 1970s, he wrote aboard, producer Tim Zinnemann and actor Dustin Hoffman brought Michael Mann briefly aboard a production that became known as Straight Time. Straight Time, directed by Ulu Grossbard, and ultimately the screenplay was done by Alvin Sargent and Jeffrey Baum, and the novelist Edward Bunker, who wrote the original novel No Beast So Fierce, on which Straight Time was based. But Michael Mann came aboard at one point to write the script, and to do that screenplay, he spent 3 months at Folsom Prison. He got a pass inside. He got to live inside it for a while. He got to conduct the prisoner's life and get firsthand experience going in and out of Folsom and talking to prisoners for 3 months. And that was a very formative 3 months for Mann. That's in the mid-1970s that he's doing that. And out of that came two original screenplays. One was Thief and the other was Heat. So when you look at Heat and you talk about, as you guys said earlier, that this is exactly the movie he set out to make, it took him 20 years to get that made, basically. It was always his dream to get that made. He made Thief first, and that he fulfilled his ambitions. But he also, with Heat, I mean, he briefly William Friedkin had thought of directing it. I mean, that's how Michael Mann was ready to let go of it when he was doing Miami Vice back in the mid '80s. So there are moments when Heat could have turned out as a very different film, but it is one of Mann's two most original films. The script entirely originates with him. And that's important to note, because other times he's adapting other materials by other writers. But here it originates from that 3 months of hardcore prison experience where he's not a criminal himself, but he's dealing with criminals. And as he said to me, I don't base my criminals on other movies. I base them on criminals I've met. I don't study crime films. I study criminals. I study actual crime. And so part of the lifelike beauty of Heat grows out of that immediacy and that desire to understand life at the level at which these guys experience it. And I think that's why by attrition, these guys become sympathetic to us. Even if we reject what they're doing with their lives, we actually are engaged with the choices that they're making.
Yeah, it's so fascinating you saying your recount with Michael Mann and the paradox between Neil McCauley and Edie and right. his rash decision, because I always looked at it as Heat, the two men and their respected families, their groups that each the cop group and then Neil McCauley and his gang, it's like these men live by a code.
Yeah.
And a code of honor and a code of respect. And I always looked at it as, this film is impending doom for one of these two guys and their groups. And, it all builds and it all escalates and you know, there's no way out for one of them. And
right.
I always looked at Neil McCauley going to take down Wayne Grow, as he knew he needed to do it, even if it cost him his life.
Mm.
And I think that is in line with a lot of Mann's seminal work. The lone wolf that lives by, you know, that lives by his own code. You know, I think to Dennis Farina in Crime Story, I think to William Peterson in Manhunter, Daniel Day-Lewis in Last of the Mohicans, even Chris Hemsworth in Black Cat. You know, Sonny Crockett, I would more so say the film version than the TV show.
Absolutely.
But, you know, it's interesting. I've always looked at Mann's films as this, and it's, you know, and Heat being the precipice of it, is just this macho alpha world that we're brought into. And with the different color tones, particularly in Heat that he uses, you know, the shades of blue, of honor and a code, it's just, you know, I've always kind of, I've always looked at it in that way. Yeah, exactly. The introspective moments of man looking out into nature.
Yeah. Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Yeah, and I mean, that iconic moment where De Niro comes home to his empty house near the beach, you know, and he's looking out through glass at that, you know, the sun is coming up over the sea, you know, and the house is empty. So we see the emptiness of his inner life, so to speak, and the infinity of the outer one. You know, it's all beautifully stated, and it's not done in a way that condemns him or judges him, simply acknowledges what's real for him, you know? And it's interesting too. This is, you know, it's very important. You mentioned Dennis Farina, you know, and he's a former Chicago cop. You know, Michael Mann met him while researching Feast. And Dennis Farina's great career as an actor, he's one of the most wonderful presences on film. Michael Mann discovered him, and, you know, part of his great beauty, Dennis Farina, is that he's real. He comes out of that world that he plays, you know. And it's worth noting that the name Neil McCauley is the name of an actual Highline thief that operated in Chicago. And, you know, Chuck Adamson, the Chicago detective who co-created Crime Story with Michael, that Chuck Adamson actually was stalking Neil McCauley, you know, at back in the 1960s. And, you know, their paths crossed. I believe it was at a post office, oddly enough. And he said, "Why don't I take you out to coffee?" And Michael Mann was always fascinated. He pumped Chuck Adamson for that tale of, you know, how he took this guy out for coffee. And they knew. They actually had a kind of friendly-ish conversation over coffee where basically, you know, Adamson read McCauley the Riot Act and said, "Look, this is all very nice that we can talk to each other and we respect each other. You're good at what you do, I'm good at what I do, but, you know, if it comes to it, I got to take you out." You know, they had that conversation happened in life. And, of course, it's the most mesmerizing moment and the indelible moment of Heat. And I think that's one reason for that. There's two reasons for that. One is that it's real life, but the other is that man with his maturing gift as a filmmaker. It took 20 years for him to get that made in the form that we know it. You know, there was the earlier TV version where the same conversation happens, but in this version, the whole movie builds to that, like a symphony, to that crescendo of that conversation. And everything after that conversation is the fulfillment of its logic, you know? And that to me is so meaningful just in terms of the example of good movie making, of how a real artist gets things done, you know? And that's, I think that, you know, it's a particular reason why, I mean, Michael Mann's work, I enjoy each of his films. I mean, there's some that I have responded to less than others, but each one, he is always coming from such a place of total intent, of fully realized intent, that I'm interested in whatever he's doing. And so in the case of Heat, I think many of us can agree that it's the sort of the Kilimanjaro of his career. It is a snow-capped peak that you just don't forget, and you can't lose from sight when you're evaluating his latest film.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more with that. I am in love with his entire filmography. I never saw Black Hat in theaters. I know it got bad reviews, but I ended up buying it on Blu-ray and Nick was just adamant that I watch it, and I watch it, and I was like, okay, I'll watch it, because I was worried that I was going to be disappointed.
Right, and you don't want to be disappointed with man, right? You know, because you love him so
exactly.
Much. Yeah, right. But, you know, it's interesting about that movie. I saw it in theaters, too, and I can understand some of the critical resistance. It's a very interesting, it's an expression of a latter-day mannerism that he's got going, you know, I mean, and we can talk more about that in a moment, but, you know, for me, that movie comes most alive, you know, 20 minutes in when the character, the woman played by Wei Tang, enters the picture, and we can feel right away the spark of her responding to the lone wolf, Chris Hemsworth, who responded to him as the man, and the spark begins to heat up between them, and suddenly he's more legible. You know, as soon as one of these lone wolves gets into a relationship, the whole movie floods on, you know? And I think, mm-hmm. you know, for Michael's purposes with, say, critics and his first audiences, perhaps, you know, the first 15-odd minutes of that film are maybe too cold and remote in their concerns in terms of establishing cyber war and cyber sabotage and that you know, setting up the world into which these characters are going to fall in love. That's a set of choices that man made that I respect, but I understand that, you know, for me too, the movie began to find its heart when Wei Tang entered it.
I would agree, and I would say that it was interesting. My response to Black Hat was unique in that the first time I saw it in the theater on opening weekend, my father and I were two of like five people, and my response when I walked out was that I liked it, I didn't love it, but that I immediately right. wanted to see it again. And right. I've watched it a bunch of times now on Blu-ray, and now it's making the rounds on HBO, and I've been yeah. or Cinemax. I've been watching it a lot at night in bits and pieces. And, you know, screw the haters. Like, if that's
yeah, really.
Your worst, if that's your worst movie, quote unquote, then you obviously have something going on. It's beautiful to look at. I think he's pushed the digital, and we can get into the digital stuff in a minute. I think he pushed the digital use in a very interesting way in Black Hat. The images absolutely are alive in very much the same way that they were in Miami Vice. And
yeah.
I think that your comment about the opening to Black Hat sort of being cold and remote, I think that there's some truth to that, but Frank and I were talking before, you know, we got you on the call here. We were talking about the opening to Miami Vice and about the and in particular the theatrical cut, which I prefer over the extended director's edition or director's cut, whatever he wants to call it, or the marketing people want to bill it as. I think the opening in the nightclub for me is one of the greatest openings to any movie in the history of the form that I have seen. I absolutely flipped out when I saw Miami. I saw Miami Vice five times in the theater, and
yeah.
every time I saw it, I lost my mind with that opening in the nightclub. And it's so dynamic, and it trusts that the audience is going to keep up with the narrative and put some pieces together that aren't being laid out in a rote expository manner, which a lesser filmmaker would have done. And what I think is interesting is you watch the extended cut, which looks great. Dion Beebe cinematography with the boats, obviously it's beautiful. But that stuff sort of feels like something that the studio would have imposed on man, been like, yo, no one's going to understand why you've plunked these people inside of a nightclub. Give us some context. And
right.
I've always felt that the opening of Miami Vice was so bracing and so amazing and so ballsy. You don't see a movie
yeah.
like this. And there's another film that very much like Heat took its time telling its story, was epic and intimate, you know, performed in the upper $60 million range at the box office, and a different type of movie, obviously, Heat and Miami
yeah.
Vice. But I feel that both of those films really are sort of like the apex of man's styles and obsessions.
Mm-hmm.
How you feel about that?
Well, I'm with you, Nick, on that. I mean, my feeling is that, you know, I got to see Miami Vice in both its forms before it came out, right? And because I was still working on the book at that point. And so, you know, and he solicited my opinion as well as others, you know. And I thought the opening of the nightclub, I encouraged him, you know, as I know some others did, you know, opens with a thunderbolt this way. He said, "You don't think that fans of the show will miss the boats?" Because he felt a certain loyalty to the folks who always loved the TV show Miami Vice. And I think, you know, because, I mean, it's like that's a fan base, you know, and you don't want to. And the Sonny and, you know, I mean, cracking tubs in those boats is a kind of, that's a gesture of the TV show. And I thought, no, because I had no love for the TV show. I was watching movies at that time. I saw a couple of episodes of Miami Vice, you know, back in the day. But really, you know, I was more about movies then. I just was going to screenings every night as a critic. So I never watched TV, you know, except when a friend of mine directed a Miami Vice, so I watched. You know, that's the kind of deal it went. But in any event, I felt, as you do, that the opening of the nightclub is more dynamic. And you know, I love it for that. You know, I think the on pay TV, the version I saw on pay TV opened boom, at the nightclub. I was so glad to see that, you know, that version is still out there. And it's interesting, though, about, you know, because Michael will, he will revise his decision making time and again. You know, there's a longer cut of Last of the Mohicans out there too. You know, and
Ali, the reworked version of Ali is a considerably different film.
Yeah. Now, interestingly enough, I saw the reworked version. First, well, it wasn't so much reworked as after 9/11, he was concerned about a few things, and he was concerned about the kind of weight that movie was carrying, because that came out in late 2001, you know. So some of the things that are developed in the longer version are, you know, like the death of Patrice Lumumba and various, you know, part of the global nature of the examination, which is all very interesting. But and in Last Mohicans, there's like a long speech that gets kind of added at the end. Man, you do not need that speech. We know exactly what's happening, you know. And so it's an interesting drama that is ongoing in Michael Mann's heart and soul as a movie maker. Heart and soul is not even the word. It's heart and intellect, because he's a rare figure as a filmmaker, because he is so intellectually vigorous and rigorous. He has lots of ideas that he wants to communicate through film. He's also has a tremendously passionate romantic nature, and I think he's very skeptical of that.
Yes.
So when he attacks one of his own movies, that is to say, attacks it on the editing table and is squeezing stuff out, you know, often he is operating like Hemingway, who would cut out the adjectives and leave in the verbs, you know, because the action gives you the experience more than an adjective which describes the experience. I completely understand that, and I see that, you know, what Mann is trying to do time and again is create the action that gives you the experience rather than telling you how to feel what you're looking at. So on one hand, I respect it. On the other hand, I think sometimes he's too cruel to his own work, because, you know, Public Enemies, for example, I saw a longer cut of that, which I said, oh, God, there are things, juicy things missing from that made it passionate on the level of Last of the Mohicans, you know, and he went into the more, you know, the dynamic action, you know, just cut to the purpose and to the action in the cut that we now have. And, you know, it's like, I get it. I get why he's doing it. And it's interesting, because around the time he did Public Enemies, he and I collaborated. He invited me to collaborate with him on a little montage for Oscar night, right, which was going to be, it's like, it showed on the Oscars in 2007. It showed on the Oscars. It was a 3.5-minute piece about what American movies say to the rest of the world about America. And, you know, and he invited me aboard because he knew that, you know, I now felt calm and comfortable with him enough to be able to push back if I disagreed with something. And he's great that way, because he's allergic to flattery. You can't flatter your way with him in any way, even to manipulate him, which I love about him, because it's like he wants to hear the truth, bang, bare knuckle, and he'll give it back to you. So we had great kind of vigorous arguments that were fun, you know. And one of the arguments I remember, you know, I said to him, hey, Michael, let's not overthink this, you know. And he had this sort of funny, inscrutable smile when I said that, and I realized, okay, I just said the words that are tuned. If he was Michael Mann's across the table, overthink is a verb that he's born in that briar patch, you know. It's like overthinking is part of the territory of who he is. And so he's going to think it about it, and he's going to try and provoke, be thought-provoking as a filmmaker rather than manipulate you emotionally. So when we're looking at the different cuts of his films, he's still trying to make an idea be born in the head of the viewer. And what are you going to do? You have to let him try it. But I think sometimes he doesn't realize that he got it right on the first throw, that by letting us have an emotional experience, we can think in the direction that he wants us to, you know?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. It's funny when I think about Michael Mann's films. You said it best with Heat being his Kilimanjaro, and I think that The Insider is quote unquote his best film. But for me personally, like, I know Nick loves Miami Vice. Like, that's his Michael Mann film, and I have a long and deep-rooted obsession with Manhunter.
Mm.
And, I mean, I've watched that film probably more than any film I've watched, and I just am absolutely obsessed with it. And I think it's, it's my masterpiece of, or I should say his masterpiece of my films of his. I totally said that wrong, but anyway, I view that. Yeah, I view that as his masterpiece for me, I should say.
Well, and it's your favorite. You know, it's the one that speaks to you. It's kind of, but you know, it's so funny. It's a bit like, you know, for me, it's what's your favorite Kubrick movie? Because, all right, I mean, do I have to choose between Dr. Strangelove and Barry Lyndon? I mean, they serve such gigantically different purposes. And then, hey, what about Clockwork Orange in 2001? And, you know, while we're at it, you know, the Eyes Wide Shut, which is, you know, a movie that, much like Black Hat, is a movie that can seem, and when I use the words cold and remote before with respect to Black Hat, don't get me wrong, I'm not criticizing it, but I'm saying that there are some movies that, especially with a passionate filmmaker like Kubrick or like Mann, where we're in effect, they're like very remote planets. The, you know, Eyes Wide Shut turns in an orbit that's, you know, really in a distant reach that you have to be Kubrick to kind of get to, or really love Kubrick and sort of move through his other films to avail yourself of, because it's he's trying to explore deeper than he's ever gone before. And I think that's what's happening with Michael Mann and Black Hat. He's actually trying to understand how the world works in a way that will teach him something perhaps about, you know, the cyber world and the digital world, which he's, you know, he's engaged with, but, you know, not every viewer is engaged with it on his level. And to a degree, I think Kubrick, having been successfully married for 40 years to one woman he was still in love with, is trying to express something about fidelity in Eyes Wide Shut that is a very tough sell for a young audience still finding its way with fidelity and romantic love, and for an older, more jaded audience of baby boomers who've been defeated a few times at love. So it's a very interesting dilemma that a great filmmaker gets into, even with his most ardent admirers. And I totally applaud you having a favorite, you know, among Mann's films. What's the one that speaks to you? It's got to be one is going to do it more than others. But that's partly because he's such a good filmmaker that every time out of the gate, he's in effect inventing the world anew.
Yeah, and that's right there what you said. It's like there's a handful of filmmakers, Martin Scorsese, Michael Mann, this is just personally speaking, the late Tony Scott, Fincher, where they feel like events, and I feel like I'm pumped to see the work. And
yeah,
it always feels like the material that those filmmakers I mentioned and many others, it always speaks to me as a viewer. And I think that's one of the things that's always grabbed me about Michael Mann's work, is that all of his films seem to exist in the same world. You could take all of his films, string them up into one, put them all on one film canister, on one Blu-ray, and attach them at the ends, and they would feel like they're in the same universe. And I think that is just, like, for me, when a filmmaker is able to do that, because I do personally believe in the auteur theory, and I think that there are filmmakers that, you know, that clearly fall into that category of thinking, and, you know, they're interested in the same themes visually and narratively throughout their careers. And I've just been obsessed with the way that Michael Mann sees the world. And I want to talk about his formal approach to filmmaking, especially in Heat, considering that it is the, you know, we're on the 20th anniversary, and he's gone into a very digital, fashion of shooting of late. And one of the things that, and which I love, and I know it's very controversial and a lot of people don't like it, but when you look at something like Heat 20 years later, that was shot anamorphic widescreen, 35 millimeter film, as best as I can remember from the trivia and the notes, the film feels different than, what's going on right now with a lot of filmmaking. And it has that filmic quality, and it has that separation of, the immediate that the digital has brought to his images, especially. I think that his use of digital has been exceptional, but Heat is just a visual marvel at one end to another. And there are some shots in the movie that still blow my mind. And there are things that I don't know if regular, and I say regular, like non-obsessives will ever notice, but there's just like, and it's so esoteric, but I want to bring it up because it's something I always think about. There's a sequence during the shootout when Al Pacino has basically located Tom Sizemore, and it's a handheld running shot of the camera. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, of where the cameraman he's running alongside of like a wall, and you're behind Pacino, and the cameraman runs up behind him as Pacino's pulling his machine gun up to take aim.
Yeah.
And it's all done in one shot, and it's absolutely brilliant. And there's like four or five instances in the film that are like that. And those moments just like they send a charge through me, like as a viewer. And I'm wondering how you feel about Mann's use of camera and Heat, and what are some of the things that have always stuck out in your head visually from the film?
Oh, it's a very important question, Nick, and because it relates to everybody else's movie making as well. There's an old adage that an era's greatest monuments are built at its close. The idea that when really great works of art sometimes come because an era is ending, and you don't realize it. And I think that the summation, the flowering of movie making on celluloid, 35 millimeter anamorphic. The late 90s is when that is, about to give way to digital, just for economic and practical reasons. And so there we are at the height of it, and we can look at Heat as like, one of the greatest specimens of non-digital movie making, is that. And when we try to understand the transition, it's important to realize too that when Michael Mann was making Collateral, he was filming on the Viper cam for the most part, which was he was in effect beta testing it for the company. He was working in digital because it allowed him to shoot incredibly low light without artificial light. So you could shoot inside a taxi cab and everything's fully illuminated, and you get the night sky over Los Angeles with that great, sort of digital receptor that the Viper cam was. Now, when you go into the nightclub sequence, however, when Tom Cruise's character is eluding, the cops and Jamie Foxx, and they're all stuck inside that nightclub, that's filmed on film, 35 millimeter anamorphic. And I said, why'd you do that? I said, well, for one thing, I wanted to use slow motion, and Viper Cam doesn't work well for slow motion. And I just knew that for this sequence, film, full traditional film, was going to work and help this sequence across. So in Collateral, you have, so to speak, a literally transitional film in which, the artist is working from several very distinct, different forms of marble, right? And now, of course, with Public Enemies and more recent films, Mann has gone over completely to the, the digital side of the equation, away from celluloid. And it has altered the aesthetic to a certain degree. But I believe, it'd be interesting to draw him out about this, but I think that he's reacting much the way the great silent directors reacted to the transition to sound film.
You look at
silent works by Hitchcock or whoever, they have a tremendous freedom visually that he was not able to obtain again until, really in the 1950s. just because the technology had to catch up to the point where he could be as flexible on film as he was able to be in the silent era. So I think Mann has got the bit between his teeth as an artist. He's just going to use the new technology and push it so that it will, you know, it can improve to the degree that it has to improve. And I don't think he sees his work as degrading. I think that if anything, he understands that if the moment is truthful, you're going to be inside it. You're going to be inside it emotionally if it's truthful. And this comes back to your observation about that moment going up behind Pacino as he's racing along the wall and pulling the arms out for his gun, you know. That happened, in effect, spontaneously. I mean, they really worked hard to get that sequence right. I mean, they choreographed on target ranges and, you know, I mean, they really built that scene with such care. But at the same time, you know, Mann was conscious that he was preparing the ground so he could preside over happy accidents, like the feeling of a handheld camera rushing up behind a camera, behind a character, I mean, creating a sense of authenticity and immediacy. You feel, in moments like that, the charge that you feel is a documentary charge. This is really happening, because you actually feel the physical presence of the cameraman racing to keep up. You don't feel that it's a...
And that was, of course, a collaboration with Dante Spinotti, who, I could be mistaken, isn't Dante Spinotti re-teaming with Michael Mann for the Ferrari film, or am I making that up?
I can't answer you. You know, I don't know that detail, but I know that it would not surprise me. I mean, they've worked together so well. They're like, the Flying Lund brothers, you know. Yeah.
I think that's wishful thinking. Not that I don't love the work with Dion Beebe and Paul Cameron. And we actually had a chance to speak with Paul Cameron about his work on Collateral, which was thrilling. That's a chat we've got coming up. We do want to talk to you before we run out of time here. You have a new book on Orson Welles.
Yes. Orson Welles, Power, Heart, and Soul, which is published by the Critical Press. It came out earlier this year in time, you know, to celebrate the centenary of Welles' birth. And you know, I'm glad you asked me about it. I mean, as with Michael Mann, you know, it's a labor of passion on my part. A filmmaker I've greatly admired and in an odd way have collaborated with, in the sense that I've adapted a work that was unproduced by him, The Big Brass Ring, adapted it for George Hickenlooper, as Frank pointed out. And so it's not a biography per se, although I have to get the biography right in the course of doing it. I have to make sure that my reader knows exactly what I'm referring to here and there. So you do get a kind of biography by reverse engineering. But what happens is that I'm taking a particular discovery that I made about Welles while working on Big Brass Ring, which is to see how deep his political engagement was, that he was very serious in his political ambitions, that, you know, when he had the Martian prank, you know, he convinced millions of Americans that Martians had landed in their backyard in 1938. FDR had him in for a meeting, and, you know, I basically encouraged Welles to think seriously about a political career, and Welles was already there. He was already thinking seriously about it. You know, people think that perhaps he failed when he came to Hollywood. He did Citizen Kane and then blew it. And no, my contention is that he was headed out of New York to Washington, D.C., and Hollywood was a detour. Citizen Kane was a kind of happy accident because he was promoting himself for the idea of a public career. And it wasn't until, you know, he's making Magnificent Ambersons, Pearl Harbor's attack, and he takes the assignment of going to Rio to do a film for the FDR administration, that, you know, he A, falls in love with filmmaking, and B, gets into such political hot water, you know, his film career is actually jeopardized and his political career kind of dies away. And so it's a very interesting dilemma that he was in the 1940s. And I really pursue that in depth because I feel that the maturity and the beauty of the films that he made after Citizen Kane, such as Othello, such as Chimes at Midnight, such as Touch of Evil, these are all meditations on power, real deep meditations on how power works in the world, and they're done with a kind of firsthand knowledge, and that's the relevance that Welles has to us today, to this day, and why his films are still alive when we turn them on.
Yeah, I just want to mention to everybody, I hope everybody who listens seeks out The Big Brass Ring. because that film is fantastic, and that flew under the radar. And, yeah, it's William Hurt gives one of his best performances in that film. He is fantastic. I mean, the guy's great in everything, but, yeah, The Big Brass Ring is it's hard to put into words because it's so intense and it's so thematically layered that it's very, you know, it's very hard to give a nutshell description of the film. All you need to know is that FX wrote the screenplay based on an unproduced Orson Welles script, and it stars William Hurt and Nigel Hawthorne. Greg Henry's in it. It's got a fantastic cast, and it's very heavy.
Thank you so much, man.
But yeah, I love it. So I just want everybody to hopefully they can find it. I'm not sure. Let me check Amazon. I don't know if it's still in production.
You can get it on Netflix. You could for a while anyway. It might still be available on Netflix.
Okay.
I'm almost positive that it is. And yeah, people definitely check out the Tashin series. It's just the filmmaker series, just a fantastic series of books. And everybody, you know, grab the Michael Mann book, the Orson Welles, the Roman Polanski. Check out FX's work, because truly, if you enjoy cinema, especially the great filmmakers, he's written some really great books about them, and the entire series in general is terrific. They've got a great Stanley Kubrick book. It's a pretty penny. They've got a really good book about Napoleon. Separate book about Napoleon is the unmade project there. Got a great Taxi Driver book as well. So FX, this has really been awesome. And honestly, I'm sure Frank and I could talk to you, for the entire night.
We'll have to attempt that. I really enjoyed talking to you both. And so at some point we'll pick another topic and run with it.
Yeah, if we do The Big Brass Ring as one of our films of the week, we'd love it if you would not to put you on the spot. But
oh, no, not at all. I wouldn't hesitate. It would be a pleasure to talk to you about it.
That would be fantastic.
We'll figure that out for sure. And everybody, just again, check out FX's work. It's really, really strong. And, from one film buff to another, thank you again for coming on the show and chatting with us. It's really been a pleasure.
Well, thank you guys. You're so welcome. And I'll talk to you again soon.
Absolutely.
Sounds great.